Shalom. I am Benjamin Summer, a professor of Bible at JTS, and I have some words to say about Parashat Tazria, the reading for this week. There are probably no Torah readings as widely misunderstood as the Torah readings for this week and also for next week, Parashat Tazria and Parashat Metsora. These parshiyot are devoted entirely to the subject of ritual purity, in Hebrew, tum'ah. They discuss what causes people to become ritually impure, how people can become ritually pure again, and what the effects of this state are. For many modern readers, this topic is off-putting. It seems primitive and far removed from the real concerns of an ethical and monotheistic religion. And yet, to the authors of the Bible, these laws were of paramount importance. They were seamlessly intertwined with the idea of monotheism. Before addressing how the laws of ritual purity express the essence of biblical monotheism, though, I'll need to clear up some widespread misconceptions about the purity laws in Leviticus. These misconceptions are not based on the Bible at all. I'm thinking, for instance, of the idea that women who are menstruating are banished somewhere outside society in order to remove them from the general population. This notion appears in a popular modern novel about biblical times, The Red Tent, but it has no basis whatsoever in the Bible. Another misconception. Many readers assume that the book of Leviticus frowns on ritual impurity, that it regards ritual impurity as objectionable or forbidden. But this is not the case. Many of the causes of ritual impurity are perfectly natural, for example, menstruation. Some are even praiseworthy. Close proximity to a human corpse causes impurity, and thus burying a dead person renders one impure. But doing so is morally admirable. As the rabbis point out, by attending to a person's burial, one does a favor for someone who will never pay that favor back. Some causes of ritual impurity were simply inevitable in the ancient world. Contact with the dead body of a non-kosher animal causes ritual impurity. But if, say, a farmer's donkey died, of course the farmer had to get rid of the carcass. Leviticus doesn't forbid farmers from getting rid of a dead donkey, or family members and neighbors from preparing a loved one's body for burial, or women from normal bodily functions. Ritual impurity is a normal state that is perfectly permissible in biblical law. What the Torah does forbid, however, was entering the tabernacle or mishkan, or later the temple, when one is in a state of ritual impurity. Further, because the Torah regards ritual impurity as contagious, it was always possible that one would accidentally share one's ritual impurity with a fellow Israelite who might be going to the tabernacle or to the temple soon. So, in order to minimize the extent to which people might unknowingly bring their ritual impurity into the temple, Leviticus requires people who are ritually impure to cleanse themselves of that impurity once they can, in most cases simply by washing in a pool of water. Depending on what caused the impurity, one typically has to wait a day, a few days, or a week or so before washing the impurity away. But, one should ask, okay, if there is nothing morally wrong with being ritually impure, and in fact there are situations in which it is morally praiseworthy to become ritually impure, why is going to the temple while impure forbidden? Why is something that is morally neutral and sometimes morally positive incompatible with God's presence? To answer this question, we need to know something about the nature of biblical monotheism. Surprisingly enough, the basic idea of monotheism in the Bible is not that there is only one God. After all, the Hebrew Bible refers to many heavenly creatures, calling them gods or Elohim. This happens in Genesis, many times in Psalms, in Job. It also refers to angels in a number of passages in Numbers, 2 Samuel, Kings, Psalms, and it refers to the Council of the Holy Ones, for example, in Psalm 89. It is God's uniqueness rather than God's oneness that is the essential content of monotheism. What distinguishes the Bible from every other religious text known from the ancient Near East or the ancient Mediterranean world is not that the Bible denies that gods like Marduk and Baal and Zeus exist. It doesn't deny that. But rather that it insists that the God of Israel is qualitatively different from all other deities and infinitely more powerful. Monotheism, then, is the belief that one supreme being exists, whose will is sovereign over all other beings, whether heavenly or earthly. The other gods of the ancient world were, in crucial respects, similar to human beings, and even to animals. They were born to a mother and a father. They could be sexually active. They often had children of their own. And they could even die, as did deities like Uranus and Kronos in Greek mythology, Tammuz and Tiamat in Mesopotamian myth, and Baal and Yam in Canaanite. But the Bible proclaims the God of Israel, the creator of the world, to be different from all other gods and from all humans and animals in precisely these respects. This God was never born, never has sex, never gives birth, and never dies. As the great Israeli scholar Yecheskel Kaufman put it in his book, The Religion of Israel, the biblical religious idea is of a supernal God above every cosmic law, fate, and compulsion, unborn, unbegetting, knowing no desire, independent of matter and its forces, an unfettered divine will transcending all being. That's the end of the quote from Kaufman. Okay, so what does all this have to do with the arcane details of Parashat Tazria and Parashat Mitzora? All the situations that bring about ritual impurity relate to the four bullet points above. Childbirth causes a high level of ritual impurity, as the opening of this week's parasha explains. Sexual activity causes ritual impurity. Proximity to a human corpse produces the highest level of ritual impurity. Contact with the corpse of a non-kosher animal causes a small degree of impurity. The skin disease, sometimes mistranslated as leprosy, that is discussed in the later part of this week's parasha, causes one's skin to be scaly and white, and thus to look similar to the skin of a corpse several weeks after death. In the mind of the ancient authors, this disease was thought of as a kind of living death on a person's body. So it, too, brought about ritual impurity. Ritual impurity, in short, is not in any way bad, but it is essentially ungodly. And so one did not walk into God's home when one is ritually impure. We can better understand impurity in Leviticus by thinking about the following situation. Imagine that while you are visiting London, you are, for some reason, invited to have dinner with the Queen. Earlier in the day, you visit the exercise room in your hotel, and you use the Stairmaster for 30 minutes, then the rowing machine, then some weights. My guess is that before you go to Buckingham Palace, you're going to take a shower, and you're going to put on clean clothes, too. There's nothing wrong with sweat. In fact, health-wise, there's a lot that's good about sweating. But we don't wear sweaty gym clothes to dinner with the Queen. Similarly, we treat God and God's temple with a certain respect. In the thinking of the book of Exodus and the book of Leviticus, the Creator of the universe deigned to leave heaven to come dwell among human beings. These books regard the tabernacle not simply as a place of worship, but literally as God's home. God decided to be, as the prophet Isaiah put it, Immanuel, with us. And yet, there is still a gulf that separates God and humanity. When the tabernacle or temple still stood, we were allowed the privilege of visiting God's house. We even had the privilege of dining with God when we presented the Zevach HaShlamim offering that is described in the first two parshiot of Leviticus. This offering, the Zevach, is not a sacrifice, but a meal shared by God and the humans who presented it. But Leviticus insists that rules govern when and how we may come into God's house. These rules, the rules of ritual purity, tell us that even when God becomes immanent, God remains transcendent. The central idea of Leviticus, I would contend, is divine grace. God graciously explains to us how to bring God into the world so that we have the privilege of being God's neighbor. But Leviticus also tells us that this gracious God remains in charge. And thus, if we want to come close to God, we have to do so on God's own mysterious terms. We are permitted to come close to God, but as we do so, we have to remember that God remains infinitely different from us. In the Torah, God is nearby, but impossible to embrace. The detailed laws of purity in Leviticus, then, are a very concrete form of theology that convey the essential ideas about biblical monotheism. Today, there is no more temple, and thus most Levitical laws of purity are not relevant on a practical level. In fact, most of these laws are no longer in effect in rabbinic law. But studying the laws of purity remains incumbent upon us so that we can see what they teach about God's closeness, God's distance, God's grace, and God's will. Shabbat Shalom. If you enjoy this program, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts and discover JTS's other series by visiting jtsa.edu/podcasts. To learn with JTS faculty in live online classes, visit jtsa.edu/online. And you can get in touch with us by emailing onlinelearning@jtsa.edu. Toda rabah for listening.